This is Channel One Over, and Nick, Jim comes in first, and then Suzanne to report, and that is Sunday morning, I guess, 24th of January, 1971, Channel One Over. I guess that's Sunday morning, 24th of January, 1971. First Jim and then Suzanne come in and report, or it could have been Saturday. This is Channel One Over. Channel One Over, and first Jim and then Suzanne come in and report. This Saturday or Sunday morning, the 24th of January, 1971. I wanted to ask you about that ground up there.
Up on the hill?
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
No. I hadn't been up there. And we didn't get to talk about it any of us, did we?
Well, I don't know how that fire was going to do it. It didn't do a perfect job, but it looks, you know, pretty good, I guess. I don't know. I tried, you know, I got where I just keep it where it kind of hit real light, mm-hmm. you know. And like you said, didn't have to dig into it. Mm-hmm. And it just did a lot better after a while. The hard part is turning the tractor. Yeah. With that long way down the end of it.
Oh, yeah.
And then it raises the front wheels because you got the disc up behind it.
Oh, yeah.
And try and turn it, and it'll get going one way, and you try and turn back, and you just turn your wheels, and it just keeps on going. You know.
Yeah.
That was the hardest part.
And then if you break it, put the brake on to turn, it'll cut up the ground.
Yeah. And that's, it kind of defeats your purpose when you dig up the ground after you just leveled it.
Yeah, that burn is gone. It's so bright on that stove. Put my eyes out. Well, now, that was, once you get into it, I mean, I lined it out for you, you know, mm-hmm. told you in general what I thought ought to be done, and then you get on the track and sort of work from there.
Yeah, you need to just feel it out yourself.
Yeah.
You can't anybody tell you how to do it. But after a while, you know, I got to where you can, when you start to turn, kind of, just turn like this a few times, you know, instead of trying to turn it on around, just kind of bind it, and you know,
just a little time.
Yeah, it turned a lot better. Right? I got on to where now it's just kind of second nature, just pulling that thing up when you get to the corner, and you know, you don't have to even think about it. Like, well, the first time you get out there, you know, one hand wants to do this, and you just kind of uncoordinated.
And then you fight it.
Yeah.
You feel like you ought to do it easier, but you.
And another thing is, at first I was out there and it missed something, you know, I want to go back and catch it, but now I got whether I just get it next round or something like that, and don't let it worry me as much.
Yes.
That's what you got to do when you farm.
Yes.
You don't try and go back and pick up something, you just go on.
No, and you know, most of the time it don't matter anyhow.
Yeah.
You can just go on and forget about it.
But I could tell when I got to the part I did from that what Bruce did. Because what I did was really had a deep furrow. You know, he leveled his out quite a bit. But it was pretty rough when it got over into the part I did, mm-hmm. trying just about bouncing, you know. Mm-hmm. But it leveled it out pretty good.
Well, those, when the plow ought to throw those furrows over perfectly level.
Mm-hmm.
And you can lift your plow, you know, back and forth there.
Somebody knows how to do it, I guess. It does it more than once. So.
Well, you just look at it, you know, keep adjusting it till it mm-hmm. does what you want. That's the beauty about doing 100 acres, you see. Then you do it, and it takes you several days, and you got it all set. This way, you got it adjusted by the time you finish.
Yeah. a large area by the time you get going. After a while, I guess you get on to it, you're bound to.
You know, one of the most helpful things on that tractor, those little bolts down there where you tighten up the...
Those little, I know what you mean. I know what you call those things.
Where you, yeah, you take up the slack out of the lift bar back there where it's not swinging all the time. And it's so simple that way. It's a lot easier that way than it is on a little Ford tractor with those bars, horizontal bars, or what do they call them? I don't know. It looks to me like, Jim, this sort of thing, on a program like you're in, you could take a little project doing things like that on something like this and see it through. And I'm not suggesting that you do it, you understand?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, because, you see...
In the forest, do you mean?
Yeah. Any of that outdoors, boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it comes in handy, though. Well, especially if you work as somebody that consults with farmers, you know, they have enough acres they want to plant trees. It's good to know something about farming, too, where you can talk to people. But they use machinery like this, and with our work, but it's, you know, of course, it's a lot bigger, a lot heavier.
Yeah.
Plowing. Because they regular to pull them up stumps and grinding stuff out.
But if you work with this, you can work with the other. Mm-hmm. And you can pull up stumps with this. Just not quite as big as the others.
You know what's surprising to me is how strong that lift is. When you want to pull something up with it.
Yeah.
Because those that disc and it fly away something. And it just pulls it right up. And somebody can stand on it too.
Yeah, especially with the leverage back there.
Yeah.
It's way out. Weighs way out. Now if you had a chance now you worked with your daddy a little bit, I don't know how much, on the car.
No.
But see, he knows, that's just one of the many things he knows. Now, you know, the sad thing is, what I say to you now, it's I may overstate it. But you see, those people you work with in university don't know much. They don't know anything about things like this.
Mm-hmm. They know book learning, most of them.
Well, I don't know what it is. It's academic,
or
something. And all those things, you see, your daddy belongs to the generation where he's learned from experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you have to, because you only had an eighth grade education. And from there on, what he knew is from experience and the way of learning, where if you're shown how to do it instead of somebody trying to explain it in a book or something.
Well,
you're watching and doing.
He got to the point, see, where nobody has to show him. He just watches them and then does it. You see, his mind works like that. Isn't that marvelous? And as a child, you know, as a young person, you don't learn as much. You see, at your age, now, you want to learn. I mean, you pick up those things, good Lord. And especially from somebody like him, if you just had a chance. It's to me like that'd be, couldn't calculate just how much you and that way, you see, you learn you don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn you don't try to learn. I know, you know, I'd love to do it too.
Mm.
Now, if you had a chance to sort of work with him up there in Georgia.
Yeah, I will. Well, Suzanne and I are going to, what we're planning on doing now, we don't know for sure. See, I'll be out of school in August. It's supposed to be. And she'll be out of school about maybe two more semesters, I hope. That'd be about March. And they'll be going up there either that January or that March. And we're going to go up there too, what we want to do. And stay there and help him. I want to help him get started on his house. You know, and we'll be able to stay there at least till the following September. And he'd already asked me, you know, that if I, well, I mentioned it to him, but he said he'd appreciate it. We need somebody to help him work, because he's going to try and do a lot of the work himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, he's going to get somebody to dig out a cellar and get somebody else to do the concrete, you know, and then maybe do some of the blocking himself. And then he's going to build a wood frame himself, because he's a good wood carpenter. And then he's going to do as much of the other as he can just by contracting a few people that know how to do it. You know?
And he can look around the neighborhood and find these fellas.
Yeah. He'll be able to when he gets up there. He's getting the paper now from there. So he'll get an idea of who's around there that does this and that, and what kind of people they, you know, who to look for this, you know. Get an idea of the layout.
But
we're planning on, Suzanne and I are planning on staying 6 months up there.
Yeah.
Taking Bubba up there, you know, where we can fence him in there too, you know.
Yeah.
And keep him there.
Yeah.
Work on
that. We might as well have two. Less trouble than one.
Yeah, Faye will have one too.
Yeah. And there's no end of the sort of work that you'll get into. The house, we're working on a house.
Well, we've built, I've helped him on 3 houses and part of another one,
mm-hmm.
of our, you know, belong to us now. And he's built, I don't know how many, well, he was, he worked as a carpenter for a long time. But
mm-hmm.
he can do it. He's good enough, and he'll just have to watch and take his time, you know. Figure out. He plans on it, you know, taking maybe 5 years to get everything done, you know, not hurrying with it.
Do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just, you know, the first year maybe get enough where they can live in it, you know, fairly well.
Get it weathered in.
And they have a well there.
Damn, that's glad. That's not, I'm glad it's shining, but looking at it.
They have a well already. One of these, well, there's an old homestead place there. And they have a well there in one of these, just kind of, you dip a bucket down in, you know, and crank up. And a stream and a spring up there. And there's another guy just bought across the road from him there. And then there's a guy has some cattle across on the other way. He has a black kind of cattle. He doesn't have these heifers. He's like you got these white face.
Mm-hmm.
There's some kind of black ones.
Mm-hmm.
But we go home and we talk about Bubba and they talk about Georgia. But they're all really looking forward to it.
Well, you know, when you get up there, you all can put in an 8-hour day and still have an 8-hour day left, you see. Because you won't have all this foolishness to do. Have a lot of time left.
Well, you can do a lot when you get started. You know what you have to do. When he built the house, everybody worked. My mother and Faye and I, well, my sister, Faye wasn't long then, but my sister and all. He had me, I was just 8 or 9 years old working on the house. I wouldn't be doing much carpentering, though, but I'd be bringing boards and stuff right there at his side. I'd go very far away. He'd have me back there in just a minute.
Is that right?
And he had it in his mind, too, that he was teaching me something whenever we'd work with him.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of other kids' fathers had been around that they wouldn't, you know, have it in their mind that they were teaching you something. But whenever he'd work on something, he'd always take time to tell me. You know, he'd take time, bring me over and teach me quite a bit.
Yeah.
And then the other, he just gave me quite a bit of responsibility early on different things. Like greasing the car and stuff like that, he'd let me do when I was really young.
You know, a lot of kids get the idea that it's they lose face and everything if they get their hands dirty. They want to do office work and pass out the orders.
Not
well,
me.
You see, the world is just full of that. You've got so much of it, you know, you can't get away from it, actually, you see, once you get settled down. And you get so, you want to get out there and grease your own dead burn tractor.
That's why I wonder sometimes about going to school and off when I enjoy more just working outside at something that, you know can't make a lot of money at, but you enjoy it a lot better. I did enjoy working with my hands. I worked for a telephone company for a while, you know, just as a guy that climbs poles and all, you know, installs phones. And I enjoyed that. And I enjoy working out here plowing, and I enjoy working on my car, you know, taking it apart and fixing the motor and stuff like that. And I'd just soon be a mechanic, you know, if you could have, of course, you can make a lot of money at it now, but. And, of course, your family's got the idea that you need an education. Of course, everybody.
Looks like they push. They don't take things as they come. Go ahead and be a mechanic for a while.
That's the way it should be, I think.
You don't want to. You probably wouldn't want to do it forever, or just do the same thing. If you're a mechanic, you'd want to do something else, wouldn't you? I mean, you wouldn't want to work under the hood all the time. So. I don't know. I think it's nice to follow your hunch a little bit. Now, Suzanne likes all those things. Does she put it? She likes them too, doesn't she?
Yeah. She not as much, I don't think. She likes to read, I think, more than anything else. You know, it's just from what she's done it for so long, I guess. And she, you know, she does enjoy it, I see. But she likes to get out and help. Well, that's why she likes it out here so much, I mean, too. But
she could do what Ms. Rollins did, Suzanne could, because she sees things, you know, and she can set them down. Is she lazy?
Suzanne?
She said
sometimes, yeah.
Sit down, say.
She's gotten better, though. I tease her about it quite a bit. But, I think it's mostly from her mother, it seemed like to me. Because when she was in high school, her mother would say that she wouldn't make her do the dishes or something because she'd have all that to do when she got married.
Yeah. She
gets married and she doesn't like to do it. Now she doesn't like housework, I think. But my sister seemed like the other way. They had to do it earlier, and it seemed like they, one of them, you know, likes it.
Now, that first summer, after she worked red with me, she was out of Texas. Just before you all got married, or just after? Before.
No, before.
And she had some books to read, and she said she read one and a half. And she got lazy.
You know why that was? That's why she, because she was visiting. You wouldn't believe what goes on when they. Well, I know it's she hadn't seen her mother in what 6 or 7 months, but they get out there and they go to town. Well, she was working part of the day, but at night they're all the time going to town and shopping, and she's carrying Cindy somewhere. To show or something, coming back, and on weekends they're going fishing with her father. And so that's probably why she didn't get him rich. Just trying to push so much time into that summer.
Yeah, I see. So it wasn't just
But you give her a chance when she doesn't have something to do, and she's kind of lazy. I guess we all are some. I tease her about it a lot.
Has somebody has to run interference for Faye? The little Faye is like that. You haven't seen
Faye. You saw Faye.
Yeah.
You know Faye.
Yeah, you just saw her, but you haven't seen much of her. Well, anyhow, she's like that. She just goes in for whatever you're doing, you see, at the time. And she has no resistance, no power of resistance at all. She doesn't have any drive and any physical.
Anyway, the wind blows.
So if she's going to get a little work done, a little reading, a little writing done, somebody has got to run interference for her. Just an easy way. But she can't do it without it. That's right. And if somebody calls and telephones and says they want to do something, she says, now, Faye, you'll have to put that on. That's all there is to it, see. But, you know, just help her. Now, I don't know whether Suzanne...
Well, I think Suzanne, she doesn't have any trouble about it. It's just work, I think. Physical work, she kind of dislikes. She's ready to go, you know, whenever... A lot of times, whenever you want to do something. But if she has something to do, she has pretty much enough... I don't know what to call it, but you know, she knows she has something to do, or work she wants to do, knows she should do. She knows for enough self control to put something pretty much off.
Now, you know. Let me tell you, you see, I think in terms of taping lifetime, but when Barbara was here, that's where I did the most taping I've ever done. Barbara turned out to be such a good reporter, so well, just beautiful. And what we did. We didn't talk much during the day, but after supper, we just, you know, just pick up on something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you just try it out. You didn't make it formal. And something would turn up always and that she could report on. Now, you see, up there, what you'd want to do, it would make it really interesting. And you see, all your family, your family's not shy. They don't mind talking. I can tell that. And they love to talk. And they don't, you just keep the microphone and everything out of sight, see. And after supper of the night, they'll report on what they've done that day.
Mm.
Now you see, the way your daddy goes about getting a carpenter to help him, that's the sort of thing that nobody knows. Now, Cookie comes out here every now and then, and I tape him every now and then, when he talks about his treason.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got so he'll talk pretty, you know, pretty realistic, you might say, about his treason. Those old horses and the cars. And it's an extraordinary process, you know. It's just complicated as mathematics. He got so many contracts, you see, and all. Well, you've heard him talk. You know how it is. And you see, all of you would have you'd have your point of view, what you're interested in. You know, you could have you all could just sit down there, and you could talk half an hour. And your mama.
And a project like this is just so exciting.
Yeah.
It seems to me, you know, not many people will do this, Jim.
Yeah.
And now this
quite
is
quite an undertaking.
Yeah, and to see...
This is what I find... Yes, you were saying.
I was just going to say, and if you could just sort of, you know, preserve it.
Look at it.
Look
yes.
at it.
Mm-hmm. Look at it. And look back at it. And you see, Suzanne is... she's literary and lecture enough. You see that she could... work with the tapes, and when you put them down, when you make them, somebody has got to write them up.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll know, you go on a field trip, you see, you can't just put on little odds and ends, you got to put on the circumstances and everything. And it doesn't take much time, and it's a fascinating thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a natural.
Yeah, it'd be
uh-huh.
natural.
Uh-huh.
It'd just be natural, you see. And now, you know, there are a lot of little things that you pick up. Now, you see, I told you I want to know about your thing up here. because I hadn't been up there. I just want to know how the ground works and how your tractor works.
Mm-hmm.
Now, actually, I wasn't interested in that. I was interested in the Georgia expedition, but I didn't want to be blunt about it, so I just let one thing lead another. I said, well, Dad, Brian, you know, you can do this sort of thing. And if you was up there, with you see, and you picked it up because you're interested in it. You don't want to be logical and mechanical. You don't want to be tricky. It's not a matter of being tricky. It's just mm-hmm. not being blunt about it. And you see, I'd say, well, what did Jim want to go up there for? If I ask a direct question, you give curious answers. You don't want to do that. You just talk, and it's implicit in it why you want to go.
But the natural question is, if the natural question of everybody, what does Jim want to go up there for? You know,
I'd love to go.
Yeah, I wish I could go. Yeah, let's all come up.
Yeah, that's nice, Jim.
Oh, that's yeah.
You want to go ride a little?
Yeah.
You gotta put a.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was in that field up there.
We can take a look at it a little later on.
Now that's Jim's visit. Jim's visit with Jim this Sunday morning. They came back. He and Suzanne came back to work with the animals this Sunday morning, the 24th of January, 1971. Channel one over. Around 3:30, they came back to work with the animals this Sunday morning, January 24th of January, 1970.
Mm-hmm. You see, I never, down here, I never find out those things. And, you know, in my classes, I never talk about the other instructors, you know that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I use their approach, you know, just in a mild sort of way. Just as bait, you see, you know, not very much.
It was the first year I was up here.
Yeah.
So that was.
Well, now you see, he started the first part of it is. You remember the book?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Well, the first part of it, he never even mentioned or ever talked about that the horse training with Abstinence. He never mentioned that at all. And he started, the first section is Slim. And I don't remember him talking about that very much,
mm-hmm.
that first section. Except sort of, he started in with Eula, as the idea that that Slim was sort of an interloper in the society. And that, he had no, Eula was just sort of this, the way Faulkner describes her as being just completely lazy. I mean, she just never moves of her own accord. And Dr. Liske talked about her as being, in the idea of mythology, as being the sort of the earth mother, just the ground, you know, that's fertile and rich, and it's just waiting to be to use to have seed and be planted. And he said, what happened? These the other people, her other suitors, all the boys who'd come to see her and then fight after they left, could recognize this in a way. But it was Flem who saw her only as a way to money and a way to social position who finally gets it. But he completely ignores what she's really for. And he, for Flem, she's just a means to an end of getting in better with Varner. And making his social position more secure. He called it materialism, but he ignores or he misuses you as natural use. She's just there, an opportunity. And in the second part, he says that the main theme in the second part is love, and he uses the contrast with Flim and Eula in the first in the second book to contrast with the idiot and Mink Snopes and I forgot the name of the other man.
That's the one that gets shot.
Yeah.
Mink shoots the man.
Yeah.
And he's writing this story too.
Yeah. Well, he's saying that the idiot, even though he's an idiot, and his love for the cow is a very real and rich love. And likewise, the other man, the man who gets shot, his love for this woman is a little bit, now I don't remember this real well, is distorted, but still it's a very passionate sort of either liking or dislike that they have. And the same way with Mink, that his hate for this other man and his defiance is a very passionate sort of human emotion, completely opposite to Flim, who's just cold, and there's no sense of that he's actual has any human emotions at all. In our sense, he's just calculating. And he said that Faulkner is just making a contrast with these other three men, the passion of love and hate, and the idea of violence is stemming from human emotions, as opposed to Flem's sort of very calculated violence where he just undermines everybody. And the last chapter, the last book, he didn't talk about that a whole lot either, except that Flim ends up beating Ratliff in the end. That Armstead, and also the, you know, in the Spotted Horses part, the idea of greed and this gullibility and the way Flim tricks all these people. Not that he bears them any malice or anything, there's no hate as there is in his cousin. Just simply, he just gets the better of him because that's just, he just calculates. And that's, I don't remember it real well, but that's basically the approach he used. He seemed to emphasize that, that part on Eula and the part about the idiot the most. The, just the Eula's nature and the other three men is emotional as opposed to Flim, who's not.
Now he thinks, and he thinks about the that story in pretty much in the same term that Flannery O'Connor thinks about her material and puts it into it. She puts those thoughts into it. She puts that thought into it and rides the thought. Now Faulkner just has a sort of a structure.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's not, you're not, I didn't say it right.
Let me see if Flannery O'Connor has her idea and she just puts her people into it for it. She just, but Faulkner, the book is there and Dr. Liska puts his ideas into it.
He, I don't know quite how you'd say it, that's it. In other words, Flannery O'Connor has the same mind as Dr. Liska.
Yeah.
Same mentality. And so Faulkner, you see, is in touch with the old world, as I call it, with Emerson, up there then.
Well, it's like the bear. Now, in the book we use Bear, Man, and God, well, the very title they put on there in the first place starts you looking in that direction, the relationship of, you know, you look in Faulkner for the land and God and the boy and the rites of passage, and all those essays lead up to that. I mean, they tend in that same direction, that you see it from an idea rather than, as you saw, it was Boone. So the question that bothers me sometimes is, you know, I can see both of them there, but I don't know whether I see the one, the, you know, the mythology and the religion and all, because I'm looking for it, because I've been told it's there, because it really is.
Well, it doesn't matter. It, I mean, it's, in my view, it's perfectly normal to, you know, discussion does this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might say that's one of the limitations of discussion and lecturing. Is they're taking
not really come out with one idea and you never think to go back and look for another one.
Yeah. now you see, you know, Suzanne, it shook me. It surprised me. When you said Jim had the idea of working on this Georgia project.
Well, the way I got it, I think that it was kind of both their idea, but I got the impression that Jim was pretty much in favor of it, too.
I mean, Jim had it and not you.
Yeah, Jim had it. No, it wasn't me. I never even thought about it.
Because, you see, if you pick up, you see, your work with me, and your experience out here, it would go directly towards that.
Yeah, well, you see, once they came up with the idea, I thought, boy, that's going to be great, you know, because I'd be right there with them.
Yeah.
You know, well, that's when Mama stepped in, and see, that
yeah.
put things on a different track for me. Now, I can pretty much ignore what she said, but still it bothered me.
Well, now, last night, after supper, Faye went back with me to take some hay to the cow. And you ought to have seen that Miss 24. She's one of the oldest because she was so proud. She jumped up and down all the way. And she got out in front of the tractor and
butted it.
And bawled. You know how they do. And she just couldn't stand it. All the way back there. And you know, I got to thinking, I said, now this thing, you know, Faye. Suzanne's mama puts that in her mind. And you know, that is one thing that happens to the human race. Women have such extraordinary power. Just one little planted idea will disturb the course of nature. Well, now, you see, I didn't mean to pass judgment. I'm just the historian of it. Now, when you get people up here as interesting as they are, and as alive, and all of them capable of experience and looking at it and reporting, that's something that won't happen again.
That's right.
Now, you know, what the most I know about how to work on a thing like that is the little experience I had when Barbara was here. We found that during the day you just went ahead about your business. You didn't just stop and talk, and you know, like we did when we come across the field yesterday. After supper, even during supper, didn't talk much. You know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
by talk,
yeah.
Sustained talk. After supper, we'd get sort of pushed back and, you know, just try out a few little things, and some would stick. We pursued. You see, I could tell what Barbara was when she kind of took hold. So I kind of held it open for her and let her, if she wanted to, go ahead. Well, now you see, on the tape, now, you see, you got to keep the thing out of sight. And you see, they're not afraid of the tape. And they're not cautious about what they say. It's just not in them. I'm sure of that. You see, you could do it together, or you could do it one by one, or both ways. And the only thing about it, after you report, it takes a while. You've got to annotate it, document it, and say what the circumstances are, and give the main points of what they say. So that you don't have to look through the whole tape, you know, to find out what was said and the bearing of it. So that's, you see, that would take the rest of the evening, take an hour or two. You don't have to play it all, but you put on your rough notes, read them up with rough. And you'd have something to work with.
What is before
the, and you'd
have,
you'd have the words.
Yeah.
And the language, isn't that be marvelous? Just language. Now you see, you'd have something Faulkner never had. And you see, Faulkner doesn't have that, so in a way what he does is manipulate this rhetoric that carries it.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it's not straight reporting. He's got a high key. He's got, you know, the charge is a little higher than it needs to be.
Than
would have to be. But see, with that to work with, you could use it. You could use it to report all those things. And then when you listen to the tapes, you hear things that you didn't hear when you were talking. So you have a lot of things.
Ready-made project.
What was that?
Well, I know that. Well, it's the most exciting.
What,
you know,
was that about?
I knew that when they suggested.
What was, Suzanne? What was that about that cat? You had a cat. Took a cat all the way with you out there.
When we were home before we left at Thanksgiving, I asked Nell. He said, "What are y'all gonna do with Dum Dum?" What's the cat's name? And she said, "Well, I don't know." She said, "What we did last time, we just got a girl to come over and feed him."
Yeah.
At night, she said, "But we're going to be gone 2 weeks, and we can't put the food out because other cats will eat it."
Dum Dum.
Got to convince Jim of that.
Dum Dum?
Yeah. That was a stupid name, but it just got kind of stuck with me. But anyway, I said, "Would you like Gemini?" Yeah. Me and my big mouth, and she said, "Would you?" I can see, you know, breaking this to Jim that we're going to carry the cat 900 miles. So he said, "Well, okay, we'll take the cat." So we just, the car is pretty much loaded. So we put a sandbox, the cat box, down the floor of the car and just put the cat in the back seat. And off we went. Well, for the first 50 miles or so, the cat yelled. You know, he didn't like it. He was scared to death. And he'd come up on the seat and he'd kind of stretch his neck out just as far as it would go and just look barely over the rim of the window to see outside. And he'd look and he'd get back down real quick. And he'd go under the seat. And he'd stay there for an hour or so, and then he'd come back out again. He'd flip up through the window, and he'd peek out again to see if that was all still going by, and then he'd go back under the seat. Well, after a couple of hours, he'd climb back up on the suitcase in the back, and he'd just lay down and went to sleep, and he'd sleep the whole way. We drove 13 hours the first day, and he slept almost all of it. Except when we'd stop, he'd get up and look around again. So when we got to the motel,
he was already broken to the sandbox.
Yeah, oh yeah, he's a year old. And he'd traveled in the car a lot before when they were kittens, because we used to take him back and forth home on weekends. And I was pretty sure he'd quiet down after he got used to it again. So after that, he'd sleep all day, and then when we'd get in the motel at night, he'd run under the bed as soon as we got inside. And he'd stay there for a couple of hours, and then he'd come out and start playing. Once he found out there wasn't anything going to hurt him, he'd start exploring. Well, the next day we put him in the car again, and he went back under the seat. But after a couple of hours, he'd come back out and he'd sleep the rest of the way. And then when we got home, of course, the dog came to the front door. The dog was the only one home, and he's barking. So I kind of opened the door real slow, you know, and let him sniff me because she So Misty would remember who I was. And then after a while, we brought the cat in. Well, of course, the cat, as soon as she saw the dog, just spit, and the tail got about 2 inches wide, and it was real fluffed up. So we rushed her back to the bedroom, and so she went under the bed. Later that evening, she decided to come out. So very slowly, he explored the bedroom first, in the closet, you know. Whenever he comes up something, he stretches out. He puts the head as far ahead of his body as he can get it. You know, it looks real funny. He just puts his body back here and his head up there so he can get away quick. And so he started exploring the bedroom, and then he came out in the hall and came to the living room, and there was the dog. The cat just froze, and the dog did too. And then Misty came up to the cat, and it was real slow, and sniffed at it. The cat just reared back and slapped him in the nose, but with the claws in.
Didn't scratch him.
No. And so after that, they got along pretty well. They avoided each other. Well, the cat, I don't think, was as worried about the dog as the dog was about the cat, because Misty had been slapped. So the cat kind of explored around the living room and started scratching on the furniture. So we thought, well, we'd have a claws clipped the next day. But came time that Mom was going to feed Misty, and she put her food in the pan, and the cat came right up because it was time for him to eat too. And Misty took one look at the cat and then just barked, just as loud as she's ever barked. The cat took off. And so Misty, whenever they'd be in the living room playing, if they'd pass each other, they'd make kind of a wide detour. But whenever it came to food, Misty wasn't going to be bluffed out of anything. She'd just bark and send the cat off. So, aside from the food, they got along pretty well. And the dog, of course, is, you know, my mother and father were crazy about it. They've always had dogs, but never one like this. And I think all the affection that they could show to each other goes into the dog. But they play ball with it and just have a little ball about that big. You throw it up in the air and she'll catch it before it comes down. She walks around with the ball in her mouth all evening.
I've seen dogs that can catch a ball.
This one's for you.
You just toss them outdoors, toss them up high.
Yeah.
They catch them?
Yeah. Jim, of course, took right to it. The dog just loved Jim. Just love him, because Jim would go out in the backyard and throw that silly ball for 30 minutes until the dog just absolutely collapsed. Just throw it, and have a real long yard, and Jim would throw it as far as he could and as hard as he could, and he'd go off down there, and the dog would start running ahead of the ball and listen for the bounce, and as soon as she heard that thud on the grass, she'd look for the ball, and she could catch it on the first bounce about every time. And they'd go on like that till the dog just collapsed.
Yeah.
And she'd tear the ball off to the side and just flop down and chew on it for a while.
Yeah.
But she carries the ball around. She just, every time, everywhere she goes, she's got the ball in her mouth.
Thinking somebody else.
Somebody play with her. Somebody comes home, you know, and she's been there alone, and she hears somebody come to the door to get in there. Before she'll go to the door, she'll pick up the ball to go meet him with it. And then she carries it to her water bowl, and sometimes she drops it in there while she drinks and picks it up again. And off she goes.
And your daddy plays with it?
Oh, constantly. He's crazier about that dog than I've ever seen him. When he reads the paper at night, the dog gets up right next to him and just lies there with the ball in his mouth. When Daddy eats supper, the dog sits there right next to him. Breakfast, lunch, supper, doesn't matter. The dog will sit right next to him, and Daddy will feed him.
On a chair?
No, not on a chair yet. On the floor. It's a pretty good-sized dog. Weighs about 25 pounds.
Yeah.
So Misty will sit there as long as Daddy's eating, but when Daddy gets through, he pushes his plate up and leans over, crosses his arms, and leans on the table. Misty leaves. She goes, somebody else is still eating.
Oh.
Until then, when Daddy's about ready to get through, he pushes his chair back from the table, and Mr. jumps up in his lap. And it's just every night the same thing. She knows she's supposed to get up in his lap, and then he sits there and talks to him. And breakfast, lunch, and he plays with the ball with her most.
Let's see, what was that little scene in the car?
Oh. Well, we decided we'd go up and see my grandparents because granddad's got cancer and we hadn't seen him that Christmas. They weren't able to come down. So Jim and I were in the front seat and Mom and Cindy were in the back seat and we all had our coats on and everything. It was kind of crowded. And Daddy was going fishing. So we had to take Misty and we had to take the cat because the cat was sick and had to give the medicine. So I held the cat. Misty got in the back seat. As soon as she gets in the car to go on a trip, she just lies down and puts her head on who's ever lap is most available. So she was stretched out between Cindy and Mom with her head on my mother's lap. Well, after a while, the cat decided he'd move around a little bit, and he got in the back, and my mother held him first and then put him back in a little ridge by the back window. And he stayed there for a while, and then he decided he didn't like it up there anymore, and he's going to get down. So he started to just go down the back of the seat and noticed that the dog was there. So he just kind of stopped. And then he put his paw out and kind of touched Misty and drew it back real quick. And then he did it again and drew it back. And then he decided he'd go ahead and be brave, and he just stepped right on the dog on a cross and got down on the floor again. And later on, he got back up on the seat and just laid down on top of the dog because that was, I guess, the warmest place.
Oh, really?
Misty was lying there and he just kind of turned his head around and looked at the cat and he said, the things I put up with.
Yeah?
And just, that's all I did.
Well, that's quite an ending to that story. And then they'd miss each other when they left, wouldn't they?
I don't know. I guess so because that cat sure did think that dog was. Just sit there and watch it.
Oh.
He'd go under a chair and sit there, all his feet together and the tail curled around, and watch him play ball.
Oh.
Just, you know, like a tennis match, his head going from one side to the other.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You know, you say on Shaw, Howard, I think of that. Well, we were talking about the big abstractions, you know, where you lose yourself. And Shaw, with that marvelous nimble wit of his, you see, really does that at the expense of the big abstractions. Now, the one Eliza at the end that you mentioned, you had that big abstraction from Dr. Robertson.
Yeah.
That the modern experience is visit the Malabar Caves.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Moore finds all the voices, but
they all end up bummed.
Yes. If that so she has to, what it so. Here's how does he apply that? And she has to make her own place.
He didn't. See how he did that. Sometimes he's kind of hard to follow.
Yeah. The society doesn't make a place for you, or the world doesn't make a place for you. The individual has to make his own.
Yeah. Well, in this, when the Shaw play, he wasn't really applying that. She was talking more about, he stuck pretty much to the play. He said that Higgins, he's saying that an individual or a person isn't a person until they assert their own rights as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
As Eliza does, he said, I'm as good as you are.
You know? Stand me for a minute?
Yeah, with
that I'm as good as you are, that I can do the same things as you, and I'm a person with my own rights and opinions. And then Higgins says, you know, I like you like this. He didn't really apply that idea to the modern experience to that.
Now, when Liza rebels against Higgins,
mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought of that as really important.
When I see Dr. Robinson does, he said that, he was talking about, he said, okay, you want to see how this myth of Pygmalion is worked out in the play.
Yeah.
Now, he doesn't drag it in by, you know, by the ears. And really, if you didn't know the myth, you could still understand the play, but he was just kind of explaining how it could work. But what he came down to is that Higgins makes Eliza what she becomes, sorry, the cultured language. And Eliza's no longer a flower girl, I mean, a flower seller, but now she is sort of a bona fide member of the acceptable class.
Yeah.
But she's not really a person. I mean, Higgins can't make her be Eliza. She has to do it herself. She has to.
I never followed it that far. You know, I'd say the plot breaks down. He's not. I would abandon this thing there. Now, I'm not correcting anybody, you understand that. But what Shaw's doing is he's doing the tacking, you see. He's doing all those beautiful, making all those beautiful sallies against the idea, you see, that the middle class has any inherited ideas or the aristocracy have anything much more than just their Oxford accent.
Yeah.
And he can, you see, he's really not setting up Eliza. All those people out in the audience, you see, are the ones he's talking to, and he's pulling them apart, and they just charm. You see, he does it with such a light heart. You don't want to follow his, you don't want to press him there towards the end. The ending is always disappointing. I realize that more and more. The end of the story, they just don't know what the end is.
He ran out of steam.
All they can do is make a statement and carry it as far as he can, and then don't burden them with it. You see, let them get out from under it. And that way you preserve those magnificent little salads of his. He has such, he has such assurance. That just delights me, you know, that Irish manner. I think the beauty of it is, you see, so much of my time, as I look at it now, Suzanne, I was reading material that had no earthly meaning, and I was carrying these abstractions around my mind that actually impeded me. Nobody ever told, and I'll tell you where that's the worst, in the Eastern schools and the European system, where they feel like they have to have the classical background, and there's nothing to the classical background. All it does is impede you, by and large. Now, I told you about that prodigal son yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you look at what it does. You know, you got to have some way of getting loose, tearing things loose, and seeing them and handling them. And you say, oh, that's nice, their treatment of the prodigal son. All he has to do, all these
adolescents who go in for dope have to do is just come home or go to church or go to the Y or go to the school and say, I goofed, and it's everybody glad to see him again. Well, that may be, but it's doing the thing, you see, that the university's doing. You come up as a freshman, and they cut you clear off from all your experience. And you substitute all this other stuff that just is burdensome. And if you're going to be a prodigal son, you at least ought to be able to look back at it, oughtn't you? And see what a remarkable experience is, see just where you are. You know, I goofed out here the most, that is, in the most costly way, and that's silage. Everything about that was costly, and everything was wrong. And I had gone into that, and I thought it was poo-poo. I put in that 12-foot silage trench out there, and it was something to dig. I can see old Buck Johnson out there now with that what do you call those things with a long neck, trying to get on 12 feet.
Oh,
and Phil Loggins came in here one time. He was out here. He's an ag man. And he looked down there and he says, now, I told him this. He says, now you think this is what we told you to do? Now you see, I goofed. But it was an extraordinary experience. And you see, your successful ideas may be the least interesting. You could go across the country and have flat tires every 5 miles, you see. And that may be far ahead of, well, I don't know what that analogy is going to do to me. I lose the point. Well, what do you know? Green car drove up. Big lanky fella with a western hat.
Well, that was the end of that's the end of this little visit now. With Suzanne, we just about folded up. We're going outside, and here came that green car scooting up. Looked like Nick. He pulled up in his old place, and here that lanky fellow with jeans on got out, and that big straw western hat, and I thought he'd head in here, but he wouldn't. He'd head out there to see his horse. And this is 1,000, Channel 1 over on Suzanne's tape. This is Channel 1 over. This Sunday morning, the 24th, is it, of January 1971. And the end of this visit with Suzanne and Jim. Jim first, up to 350. And then Suzanne. This Sunday morning, Channel 1 over, the 24th of January, 1971.